Ersel hocam söz alabiliyor muyuz?
Can you hear me clearly?
Konuşmadan sonra Sıtkıcığım.
Tamam hocam, benim de bir merhaba demek istemiştim, onun için sordum hocam.
Hemen deriz. İstiyorsan söyle hemen.
Şimdi söylüyorum. Hey, Sir Mersheimer, this is Sitki Egeli, one of your students from 89.
I remember you well.
Yes, you do. I'm glad to hear that. Yes, we want to have written about close air support. It's great seeing you.
Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Correct. Very correct.
Hi, John.
It's great seeing you. You look great. Okay, talk to you later.
Hi, Meltem.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good to see you.
Good to see you.
All my students are here waiting eagerly for your talk.
I hope I won't disappoint them.
Of course you won't. Sorry, I missed you. Couldn't come to ISA last week.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I missed you too. I think a lot of people from outside the United States could not get in, or it was not worth trying. Hopefully, we'll be back to normal next year.
I'll be in Chicago in 10 days. I'll send you an email.
Oh, yeah, please do. I saw Schenner the other day.
He was in Chicago.
He was in Chicago, yeah. Yeah. And okay. How many people do you think will be on this?
I think, no, 300 actually registered for it.
Wow.
Yeah, and the 300 is the limit anyway that could register for an institutional talk.
I see.
But it's also being live streamed, so some people might prefer viewing it through that.
I see. Good.
I'll just give a few minutes for people to get in.
Sure. And where is most of the audience from? Are they mostly college students and professors, sort of an academic audience?
I think it's a very healthy mix.
I see.
It's also it's not limited to Turkey at all. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I see. So there are people from outside Turkey as well.
Yes.
It's truly amazing what you can do with Zoom.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I was in India a half hour ago.
Oh my. I just flew in yesterday, actually. I'm in Berkeley now. I'm a little jet lagged, so
but I was virtually in India.
Oh yeah.
Just like I'm virtually at Bilkent. It's just amazing. You can just sort of flit all over the world.
Actually, it is. I mean, that's been the discussion, how it compares, in-person conversations, because we've been doing this Zoom now a lot. And sometimes I wonder, how different it is than the in-person meetings, whether there is any really qualitative difference at the end of the day. So
yeah, I find with regard to teaching that seminars where if you have, let's say, 16 or 17 students, it's fine. I feel as comfortable as I do in the classroom. But once you go to a large lecture, actually something like this, it's very impersonal because you can't see anybody. You can see one or two people.
Yeah.
I just did a TV show, CNN India, earlier this morning. And there I looked at myself as I talked, which is kind of bizarre. I mean, I've done it enough times now that it's not that unusual. But, looking at yourself as you talk is kind of crazy. But
that's true.
But the other thing is that I get you, because of my interest in the Ukraine issue, I get huge numbers of requests to do interviews because people can do it virtually. So anyone who thinks it would be a good idea to interview me emails me. And there's no way I could possibly do all those interviews. I'd never go to sleep. And I still probably wouldn't end up doing half of them anyway. But it just shows you how, you know, being able to operate virtually really increases, I don't know what the word would be, the interactions, the intercourse, you know, among individuals, because you can just get to each other, reach each other so easily.
No, that's really true. Some people think that this might have a huge impact on the future of even the education because of, you know, more and more now institutions are really interested in pushing for this online one. And so speaking of Ukraine, of course, it's, I hope people, you know, kind of, they're gonna listen to something about IR discipline, but maybe they will have Ukraine in their mind, particularly when you are the speaker. So I hope they can make that distinction. Yeah.
I'm glad to talk about anything.
Yeah. Okay. People are still coming in, but maybe we can start so they still can come in, actually. First of all, welcome to the All Azimuth Senior Scholar Talk Series. I wanna thank for a few people before I really present the speaker to you. The from our department, Eliza, we are very thankful. She was in between, and also I thank Dr. Onur Erpol and Gizem Koçver from our center. For planning and really organizing this meeting. For those of you maybe who don't know, our journal All Azimuth is currently celebrating 10 years of publication. And we are really committed more than ever to being a scholarly venue for ideas and voices from outside the core hegemonic knowledge centers. Actually, that's how we would like to also kind of present it. One of the greatest challenges against IR and IR theory has been the recent years' global IR, so-called global IR push. As All Azimuth and as an IR scholar myself, someone who wrote on the idea of global IR more than 20 years ago, when I was still a graduate student at McGill, I very much want to see this idea go beyond being just a fad to become a truly healthy and a transformative debate. It must not remain just a fashionable cause with its own climate and stars, but adding only to the graveyard of inconclusive initiatives. So this is why we are holding this All Azimuth series talk today. And I really cannot imagine a better intervention to spark healthy debate than to introduce Professor John Mersheimer into the discussion. I don't think John needs a detailed introduction to you, other than saying that this is not a talk about Ukraine. And our format today, we have an hour and a half, and John is going to talk for half an hour, more or less. And then we are going to have an hour of Q&A, which is going to be led by Onur Erpol, our managing editor and also postdoctoral fellow in our center. So again, as I say, it's my very great pleasure, therefore, to introduce a person who needs no introductions, speaking to us today, Dr. John Mersheimer. Thank you, John, for accepting to talk to us.
You're welcome, Ursel, and thank you for the kind introduction, and thanks to everybody for coming out to listen to me. Basically, what I'd like to do to answer the question on the table, is IR theory global enough, is to, in effect, contrast my views with Ursel and Ohner's views as they laid them out in an important article they published last year. I actually have not written much on this subject. I've thought a lot about it over the years because it's hard not to think about it if you're an academic. But I've not written much. I have a very short piece in International Studies Review in the year 2016 called Benign Hegemony. But they wrote a piece that was published last year called The False Promise of Global IR, Exposing the Paradox of Dependent Development. And that was published in International Theory, the journal International Theory. So what I'd like to do is sort of lay out my thinking and contrast it with their thinking. Now let me just tell you my initial view, my quick take on the question of whether or not IR theory is global enough. I think IR theory is global in the extreme, and I think that this is a wonderful situation. As a good realist, I don't like the phrase global village, right? When I hear the word global village, it makes me nervous. But I do think, as an IR scholar, I live in a global village. I think we all basically speak the same language. And by that, I mean we talk in terms of the same theories. And English is the language that everybody speaks who engages in IR theorizing. You know, when I go to countries like Turkey or Japan or Mexico, invariably after I'm done speaking, my host will ask me the question, how is it different talking to Turkish students or Mexican students from talking to American students about the issue I'm talking on? And I always say, there's no difference at all. I get the same questions everywhere I go. We speak the same language, and it's not just English, although it is English. We speak the same theoretical language, right? I would note to you that I am a terribly unpopular person in the West, but in the non-Western world, I am remarkably popular. China and Russia are two countries that I can go to where I basically speak the same language in terms of IR theories that most elites in those countries speak. As many of you have heard me say, I'm sure, when I go to China, I always say when I talk, or I almost always say when I talk, it's nice to be back among my people, right? Now, I don't speak a word of Chinese. I can't even recognize my own name in Chinese. I'm kind of the typical ugly American in that I only speak English. But intellectually, I'm at home in China, and I'm at home in Russia when I talk about IR theory, right? So for me, it is a global village. And you know, again, the question, is IR theory global enough? Yes, it is very global, and that's wonderful. Now, Ohner and Ursel have a different answer. Their answer is it's not global enough. Now, they agree with me that we all speak the same language, both in terms of English and in terms of the theories that we use. So there's no disagreement between us there. Right. But where they disagree and where they think IR is not global enough is that they believe that virtually all the theories are developed in the West, that we have remarkably few, if any, non-Western theories. And they use words like core and periphery as synonyms for Western and non-Western. And their basic view is that in the non-Western world, there are no genuine, this is quoting them, no genuine homegrown theorizing. There is no genuine homegrown theorizing. It's all those Western theories that are basically in their story sort of pushed on the non-Western world, pushed on the periphery. And they talk about dependency theory, and the whole idea is that the non-Western world is dependent on the Western world because the Western world imposes these theories on them. So in a nutshell, that's why Ohner and Ursel have a very different answer to the question of whether or not IR is global or not. And again, I say it is global enough, and I say it is, and they say it isn't. Now, I'd like to talk in more detail about my views on Ohner and Ursel's piece and talk about where I agree with them and where I disagree with them. And this will allow me to lay out my own thinking on this issue. Just as a starting point, I agree with a lot of what they say. When I read their piece, it wasn't like I was in disagreement from start to finish. On the contrary, I agree with a lot of what they say. We have disagreements, which I'll go into. But first of all, I like their focus on theory. As some of you probably know, I have been given to say that theory is God. So I love theory. I think privileging theory is a good thing. And they privilege theory, right? And you want to, and this will become clearer as we go along, you want to always remember that there's a difference between theory and methods, right? If you get training in methods, that does not mean you're getting training in theory, right? So there's a real tension between theory and methods, and they complement each other as well, but there's a tension there, right? And there's a tension between theory and empirical work, and there's a tension between theory and hypothesis testing. So I put methods, empirical analysis, and hypothesis testing in one basket and theory in the other basket. And I privilege theory and they privilege theory. So we're on the same page there. I think they're absolutely right about the primacy of the West. This is a Western dominated business. The core dominates the periphery when it comes to developing theories, okay, which is what we're talking about. And I think it's the Anglo-Saxon world, the Americans and the Brits, who dominate within the West and therefore dominate on the planet. They're obviously right about the primacy of the English language. The mere fact that I'm speaking in English and virtually all of you understand what I'm saying speaks volumes to that point. They're absolutely right about the primacy of Western journals, you know, getting an article published in the APSR or International Security or International Organization. This all matters enormously. And they're also right about the primacy of Western universities. And you see this in two very different ways. First of all, places like Bill Kent and places all over the world emulate, try to imitate Western universities. And furthermore, some of the best students in countries like Turkey or countries like Mexico, you name your country, in the non-Western world, want to go to the West to get educated. The number of Chinese who want to come to the University of Chicago to study with me is off the charts. So you have some of the best students in countries in the non-Western world wanting to go get educated in the Western world. And then you have universities in places like China, places like Turkey, that are imitating Western universities. So I agree with them on all those points. They're right on the money. Where I disagree is I don't believe that the core is imposing its theories on the periphery in a malign way. The use of the word dependency theory as a way of describing what's going on doesn't accord with sort of how I see this. And of course, that's why my little article, my 2016 article I was telling you about up front, is entitled Benign Hegemony. I think that you could call me somebody who believes in benign hegemony, and Onur and Ursel as two people who believe in malign hegemony. Now let me unpack for you why I disagree with them on this issue. First, what are homegrown theories, right? In other words, this is their word, homegrown theories. Homegrown theories are theories that are developed in the periphery or in the non-Western world. And I think that you have to tell me what the specific characteristics are of those theories that differentiate them from, let's say, Western theories. I don't even like the word Western theories, because in my brain, theories are just theories. Theories are just generalizable statements about cause and effect. If this, then that. I don't see them as something that applies to a specific region or comes from a specific region. Just to take realism, for example, realism is a general theory, right, that applies in countries like Turkey. You could use it to explain American, Turkish foreign policy. You can use it to explain Chinese foreign policy. How far it takes you is debatable. But I don't know what a homegrown theory would be. Realism, certainly not a homegrown theory. It was invented in the West, but it could have easily been invented in Turkey or in Japan or in Mexico. I mean, if the circumstances were different, it just happened that it was invented in Europe. It wasn't even invented in the United States. When we talk about the Anglo-Saxon world, right? The Germans were way out ahead of the Americans in terms of developing basic realist theory. And also just the subjects that we study. I mean, take nuclear proliferation. People in the non-Western world are interested in nuclear proliferation. If you're Turkish and you're looking at Iran and what Iran is doing on the nuclear front and what Saudi Arabia has said it would do in response to Iran developing nuclear weapons, and you start to theorize about nuclear proliferation, is there going to be a homegrown theory? Are Turks going to come up with a homegrown theory that is different than the theories that are out there? Maybe, but you have to tell me what a homegrown theory looks like. Just has to be defined. And I don't see that. And I can't sort of invent an argument for myself as to what a homegrown theory looks like. Second point I'd make is, where are the homegrown theories that have been sidelined? In other words, if we live in a world where you have sort of this imperial Anglo-Saxon world that wants to dominate and wants to keep homegrown theories down, where are the homegrown theories that are being kept down? I don't think that Onur or Ursel provide any evidence of homegrown theories that have been kept down, and I can't think of any. And by the way, I want to make it clear that theories can be kept down, right? They can be suppressed. Carl Schmitt, who's one of the great thinkers of the 20th century, was a Nazi. He was a thoroughgoing Nazi. He was a reprehensible human being, but he was a brilliant theorist. From the end of World War II, 1945, until the middle of the 1980s, I'd say 1985, for about 40 years, his theories were suppressed, right? You just didn't talk about Carl Schmitt. You didn't read Carl Schmitt. That's all changed now. But you can suppress theories. So I think it's theoretically possible, plausible, that theories are being sidelined. In other words, there are homegrown theories that are invented and then they're suppressed. But I don't see any evidence of that. Now, the response that Ohner and Ursel could make to me is, yes, that's true, but those theories have never been developed because the pressure to conform to the Western way of doing business and the pressure to adopt Western theories and talk in terms of Western theories is so great that all you get is imitation and no innovation. Does everybody understand that point? Because I think in very important ways, that is at the heart of their argument, right? That it's more than the fact that there just aren't homegrown theories out there. It's that you can't develop homegrown theories and you can't develop them because the pressure to imitate the West is so great. And of course the West is so powerful, or the core is so powerful. Now, I think this is true to some extent. There is a powerful imperative to imitate, and I'll talk more about this later, but you want to understand there's a powerful imperative to imitate inside the West itself, right? But there is also a powerful imperative to innovate. Anybody who comes up with a clever theory or an new theory that explains things in ways that differ from the established theories is going to become awfully famous. And there are a lot of people out there who want to be famous, right? I know that. I'm one of them. I wanted to be a major figure. And I have lots of friends over the years who wanted to be major figures in the world of international relations. I can't believe there aren't lots of people in countries like Turkey, countries like Mexico, you know, in the periphery, countries like South Africa, who want to be famous, who want to leave their mark, not in a bad way, in a good way. And you can't do that by imitating. If you imitate, you're just a ho-hum scholar. You're just imitating what everybody else does. You're following the pack. So the point I'm making to you is, yes, there is a powerful imperative to imitate, but there is also a powerful imperative to innovate, to come up with a new theory. And boy, if you came up with a non-Western theory, what Ohner and Ursel call a non-Western theory, you really become very famous. And that theory would travel. Theory travels, right? The idea that the West would be able to suppress it. First of all, I don't think that's the way the West works, but you wouldn't be able to suppress it. Not with the internet anyway, not in this day and age. So anyway, I think there are no theories, non-Western theories that are being suppressed, right? I think what's going on here is that the West got there first. These theories like realism were developed in the West, the West has huge amounts of resources. It's incredibly rich. It has these powerful universities, and they have done an excellent job of purveying their theories all across the planet, which is why I can go to Turkey, go to Japan, go to Mexico, and talk to students the same way I talk to my students in a class at the University of Chicago. We all speak the same language. We all focus on the same body of theories and so forth and so on. It's just the way it works. I don't believe it was done in a malign way. Now, let me go to the whole subject of the prospects for changing this situation, okay? Whether you agree with me that we have this Western hegemony or this Anglo-Saxon hegemony for benign reasons, or you agree with Ohner and Ursel that we have this Anglo-Saxon hegemony for malign reasons, there's still the question of how do we change this situation? I actually would have no problem if there were more non-Western theories. I love theory. And if non-Westerners want to develop theory, fine. As I told you, I love going to China. The Chinese are my people. We speak the same language. So it's not like I'm unhappy about the fact that non-Westerners are employing theory or would develop theory and so forth and so on. I have no problem with that. So I think if we can figure out how to fix this situation so that there are more non-Western theories, that's good. And I think that Onur and Ursel would agree with me on that. They surely would. Now, they spend some time in their article talking about how to improve the situation. I have a fundamental disagreement with them. I think the situation is grim for non-Western theory, and it's going to get worse. And they're whistling in the wind when they come forward with proposals to how to fix this problem. Now you're saying, why is he saying that? Now you want to remember before I go on that we're talking about theorizing, right? We're talking about non-Western theories. That's their focus, that's my focus, right? And I'm telling you the situation is going to get worse. Why is that the case? First of all, we are moving away from an emphasis on theory. Theory's privileged position in the West is diminishing. It's very important to understand that. And methods, empirical research, and hypothesis testing are now what scholarship and IR is all about in the West. Very important for you to understand that. We teach many methods courses. We go to enormous lengths to socialize students to take methods, to study methods, to do empirical research. We teach hardly any theory courses. And IR theory really has a bad name at a lot of universities now. And I mean that literally. If you say I'm an IR theorist at a number of Western universities, you're considered to be a dinosaur. Many of my colleagues at elite universities in the United States think that I am a dinosaur. Now, there are two reasons for this. One reason that theory is being diminished in importance is there's really not a lot new to be said. Much has already been said. If you're going to write about realism, it's not clear that there's a whole heck of a lot new to say. If it was 1945, it's 1945, you just got a PhD at an elite university in the United States, and you're interested in writing about IR theory, the world is your oyster, as my mother used to say. You have lots of opportunities to write interesting theoretical treatises. In the year 2022, you're following behind a lot of people who've said a lot of things about IR theory, and there's not a lot new to be said. That's one problem. The second problem is we are now in the business of mass producing PhDs. When I started graduate school in 1975, the number of PhD students who were being produced in IR, especially in security studies, was remarkably small. This is a completely different world than the world that you live in. And we now live in a world where there are huge numbers of people who want to get PhDs, right? The non-Western world is filled with young people. Many of you are on the screen here who want to get a PhD. This is wonderful, but you want to understand that that means we're mass producing PhDs. It's an assembly line. I love this phrase. This is from Onur and Ursel's piece. They talk about quote unquote, graduate training factories. Graduate training factories. They're exactly right. We have these universities all across the planet that are graduate training factories, pumping out huge numbers of PhD students. We have all sorts of people go into MA programs who want to then go on to get a PhD. Once you get into mass production of PhDs, there's going to be a heavy reliance on empirical approaches over theoretical approaches, because you can't mass produce theorists. You can only have so many new theories. You can mass produce people who do empirical research. You give them some courses in statistics and this and that. They get spun up on methods, and then they take their methods, they apply them to specific problems, they create new databases and so forth and so on. Think about a public policy school. If you're going to create a public policy school and you're going to admit 300 students a year, and those students are going to be in for 2 years, and you have to educate them, what kind of courses are you going to teach them? Theory courses? You think you're going to teach them to be great theorists? You think you're going to teach them to be big thinkers? No. You're going to teach them all sorts of courses on methods and econometrics and so forth and so on, so they can be competent analysts when they go work for, you know, Goldman Sachs or the US government or the Turkish government or what have you. Public policy schools, right? Just look at public policy schools and how they educate people. That's what you get when you mass produce PhDs. So what I'm telling you folks is that the future for IR theory across the planet, in the Western world and in the non-Western world, is bleak, because one, there's not a lot new to say. There's some, but not a lot. And number two, we're mass producing PhDs, and that means theory is going to be shortchanged and empirical methods are going to be emphasized. The other reason I think the future looks grim and the situation is going to get worse, not better, as Oner and Ursel hope, has to do with the growing conformity in the West that comes out of professionalization. You want to understand that in the West, let's focus on the West here. In the West, we have had a very profound movement towards professionalization since I first got into this business, really when I started graduate school in 75. So from 75 up to the present, that's a lot of years, almost 50 years. The business has become much more professionalized. That means there are all sorts of rules that you have to follow. Professionalization is really all about creating an iron cage that has rules. It demands conformity. It used to be in the old days, if you submitted an article to IS, to International Security, you just write something, you'd stick it in an envelope, and you'd send it to International Security. There was no format that it had to follow. You didn't have to answer 10,000 different questions in conjunction with submitting your manuscript, right? That's no longer the case. Submitting an article to International Security or any journal is a highly professionalized business, no matter where, right? And you see this in the non-Western world as well. Professional standards really matter, right? And that means conformity. That means conformity. And that conformity in the Western world is going to seep out into the non-Western world. And you can see professionalization. You folks, especially your young people, you want to think about professionalization. You want to think about what professionalization means. Political science is becoming a profession. And when a discipline like political science and IR becomes a profession, it has a narrowing, a constraining effect, okay? And that's happening in the Western world, and it's seeping out into the non-Western world. And just on this point, let me conclude by saying, I read Ursel and Oner's piece very carefully. It's a superb piece of scholarship, even though I disagree with them on certain points. It's a superb piece of scholarship. But it is a highly professional piece in the Western sense of the term. They have written a piece that looks like something that would come out of an elite university in the United States. And of course, it was published in International Theory. And when I read their piece, I see this. And by the way, it's a piece that's very empirical. very quantitative, very methods oriented. And I'm not being critical. I want to be clear. I'm not being critical of the piece. The piece is first rate, but it's not an IR theory piece. And it's very professional. And it fits neatly with my point as to the direction that we're heading in. So let me conclude by making three very quick summary points. First, the West is hegemonic. Ursel and Onur and I will agree on that regarding IR theory. Is it malign? No, I think it's a benign process. They think it's a malign process. So there we agree. Is this going to change? They're hopeful that it's going to change all for the better over time. My view is it's going to change for the worse over time. Thank you.
Thank you, John. It made me, of course, revisit the article. So thank you for that. I'm going to say a couple of things so that the audience can prepare their questions and send it to Onur, because Onur is going to really kind of categorize them and then bring them up to the floor. Obviously, there is so much to be said. Maybe later another form of communication would be necessary. Interesting that our studies, because we finished another study, it's been submitted now, about the peripheral journals. We wanted to see how things are also being produced in the peripheral journals, and then see also the role of English and non-English, what happens in non-English journals and et cetera. There, because you asked the question, where are those theories, you know, homegrown theories, where are they? Are they really, do they exist or they're not? That's what we wanted to see too. There we saw that if something is not somehow brought in English, into the attention in the core, that there is a very, very little chance that that ever sees the day of the light. We also show that empirically. And for example, this is about the role of English, maybe, because I think that's one of the key mechanisms that this dependency or dependent development is working on. The journals, non-English journals, have been actively they told so, even literally told so, to turn into English production by the indexes, so that they could get more citation. And then, unfortunately, one of the very recent development is the Turkish journal. We have Uluslararası İlişkiler International was in Turkish. I understand that they made the decision to now publish it in English. How many? I don't know, after maybe 20 years. And then that's been the reason. So you can see this mechanism is really pushing for a certain type of production, certain type of products, and certain type of even philosophies and theories. Therefore, you can make that argument. But one thing that... I'm filling in for the questions to accumulate. The IR theory may not be the privileged label anymore in the West, but it is in the periphery. Within these small communities, still many scholars, young scholars particularly, they try to find, to open a path for themselves in these communities by presenting themselves more like a theoretician rather than area studies or historians. That's an interesting, I think, the difference between the core and the periphery. So you can see this kind of the old image of the core being extremely active in the periphery still. So when the the label theoretician or the IR theoretician is that popular in the periphery. That means only one thing. Again, our studies show that they always imitate, they always import. And then we see that again in our empirical evidence that, for example, they don't cite local works. They only cite the English conventional IR theoretical pieces, even if there are non-English theories or even in local language. Again, our empirical evidence shows us that they insist citing the core IR theoretical pieces. Why is this important? Just one other line. That evidence tells us that the imitation in the periphery is a self-imposed one, mm-hmm. rather than a core provoked one. That dependency is so consolidated that the peripheral IR communities, they are rushing to import. They are rushing to import and imitate. Of course, that speaks to your point that IR theory maybe has been extremely successful in the West, so that there are this many followers in the East. Maybe this should be the last kind of quick point. I think the globalizing IR theory is not only to serve to the interests of the peripheral communities or the scholars. It is, we try to also present it, it is a way to also salvage the gap between the IR theory, current IR theory, and the world politics, because 80-90% of the IR actions do take place in the periphery. We are talking about even Ukraine. Ukraine is not necessarily the center of the West. We are talking about, for example, terrorism, political violence that has been also in the periphery. Yet the ideas that define our scholarship comes from that 10% or 20%. That appears to be a major paradox for the future of IR discipline. So how do we close that gap? That was one of the questions we had in mind. So I will stop mumbling here, so that the owner can maybe then start the Q&A section.
Sure. Okay. Now I believe the original ground rules was that everybody sends me their written questions, and I'll do my best to categorize them and convey them to Dr. Mersheimer. I think we can have a more hybrid format if that's okay. I think there are a couple of people who really, really want to ask questions and questions live as well, if that's okay with you. Let's do it that way. With that, let me first of all turn to Dr. Gyorgy, who wanted to say something. And after that, I'll continue with the questions that we received, okay? Hang on, let me also make this. Sorry, yeah, there we go.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Great to see everyone. Thank you very much, Professor Mersheimer, for your fascinating talk. It was very enjoyable, as always. My question for you has to do with a seminar that I sat in, or that you taught at the University of Chicago a few years ago, a landmark experience in my academic life. And I remember you saying that, well, one of the theories that we don't have yet, because the focus of attention just hasn't been on smaller actors, weaker powers in the international system, is a realism for, or a realist theory for small powers. How much of a gap do you think this is? And what would you say about the fact that a lot of these theories explain phenomena for the countries where they come from? And because these are very few countries in just about 10%, as Professor Idleman was saying. They are universal, they are important, but at the same time, there are still some important issues that they are not able to explain. So I would be curious to see your opinion on this. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say I get maybe 3 emails a year from people who say to me, you have this theory of realism, and it's all about great powers. And what does your theory have to say about small powers or minor powers? And I always write back. I don't always write back. Sometimes I'm so inundated with emails, I can't write back. But when I do write back, I always say to people, this is a great question, and I have no answer because I've never thought seriously about it. And I usually give people 3 or 4 thoughts off the top of my head, and I tell them, take this with a grain of salt. But just to go to Eliza's question, this is, I think, a black hole in the theory world. Remember, I said I didn't think there was much room left for new theories, but this is one of those areas where there is room left for theorizing. How does realism apply to countries that are not great powers? And you could distinguish between Belgium on one hand and Turkey on the other hand and India, right? Because in the world we live in, we say there are 3 great powers, the United States, China, and Russia. That leaves a lot of other countries out there. Some you could categorize as major powers, some as minor powers. So this is an excellent question in the sense that this is a black hole, right? And there are other black holes out there. But the point I was trying to make is there are not that many black holes left.
Okay. And all right, then. Thank you, Professor. Let's now start getting into some of the questions. Now, the first one I'd like to convey to you is, this is by Dr. Jeremy Garlick. Professor, you said that there's not a lot more to be said in terms of theorizing, and this is basically a kind of attitude that was prevalent among physicists, for example, in the 19th century. But then all of a sudden, you know, in the 20th century, Einstein came along, completely revolutionizing physics, for example. Could we not have this type of development, this type of new insight in international relations? So could there be a revolutionary change like that for IR theory?
Yeah, I think the answer is that it's somewhat difficult to predict the future. And when I say that there's not a lot of room left for theorizing, and again, I want to make it clear, I'm not saying there's no room. I'm just saying I don't think there's a lot of room left for theorizing because a lot's been said. That doesn't mean that, you know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, I'll be proved wrong. With regard to physics, I think that was true. With regard to physics, that people who said that it was dead and there was no room for theorizing before the start of the 20th century were proved decisively wrong. I think if you look at physics today, it's not clear that there's much left room for theorizing. I'm not an expert on the subject, but I read a little bit about string theory from now and then, and I'm not sure there's a whole heck of a lot new to say there. That's not to say there couldn't be a breakthrough at some point, but I think that a lot of people in IR will tell you there's really not much new to say about realism, Eliza's question to me notwithstanding. There's not a lot new to say about realism. And I'm not saying there's nothing new again, but I think you don't want to underestimate the fact that so many scholars have said so much of a theoretical nature. I think, by the way, the same thing is true about liberalism. And the same thing is true about social constructivism. Alex Wendt once dominated the landscape in social constructivist theory. Where is his successor, right? Where is the rich body of new social constructivist theories. In terms of liberal theories, we have democratic peace theory, we have economic interdependence theory, and we have liberal institutionalism. Those are the big three liberal theories. Can anybody think of coming up with a fourth liberal theory? I don't know. Maybe you can. You know, maybe 20 years from now, we'll have a fourth theory. You want to understand that when I went to graduate school in the 1970s, there was no such thing as democratic peace theory. Democratic peace theory was basically invented by Michael Doyle in 1983. There was no democratic peace theory, right? The argument that democracies don't fight other democracies, and nobody anticipated it. So maybe somebody will invent another liberal theory in the foreseeable future. I'm not optimistic on that front. And I say that with great regret. But we will see whether I'm right or wrong.
Professor, if I may then ask a follow-up, because we also received a question about this. Do you see mid-range theories, right? These eclectic theories, they're on vogue as well. They're very popular these days as well. And do you see them being able to contributing to extant paradigms? Do you think they will be able to actually contribute something significant to IR theory? And by that token, do you think they could be used to promote global IR as well?
Yeah, my focus over the past few minutes was on grand theories like realism, liberalism, social constructivism, and your question has to do with middle range theories.
Right.
I think there's no question that there is more room for work in terms of middle range theories than there is at the level of grand theories. I want to be very clear on that. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of spade work has been done in terms of middle range theories as well, right? So this is not like 1975. Just to give you an example, when I went to graduate school, I wrote a dissertation on conventional deterrence, which became my first book. And conventional deterrence offers a middle range theory. I did not start off as a realist. I became a realist much later in the game. I didn't even self-identify as a realist when I went to graduate school because I was obsessed, as were most of my classmates at Cornell, we were obsessed with middle range theories, right? But a lot has been done on subjects like conventional deterrence. A lot has been done on coercion and so forth and so on, these middle range theories. But this is not to say that more work cannot be done, right? I believe that more interesting work will be done in terms of middle range theories and even in terms of grand theories. But my argument is that a lot of work has already been done.
Thank you, Professor. While I'm waiting for more questions to be asked, let me quickly turn over to Professor Utsutoksoy. I think you were about to leave and you want to ask something, so please go ahead.
Thank you very much for prioritizing the question. I have to teach a class at 6:45, therefore I'm going to have to leave. And I have very short two questions. One of them actually was supposed to be the second one, but because Professor Mearsheimer just talked about the social constructivism and so on and so on, I wanted to bring that question up first as a follow-up. Actually, when we talk about local or homegrown theories, does this really not take away from the general applicability of theories in the social sciences? And in terms of this, you know, the positivist post-positivist debates, have we gone too much into the postmodern era and made it impossible to theorize? That would be my first question. I'm an assistant professor of international relations at Doğuş University in Istanbul. And for the last 10 years or so, I've been working on science, technology, and international politics and space politics in general. And just because you also specified string theory, I'm also wondering whether we social scientists are kind of losing our way in terms of knowing what really theorizing means, because the way the hard sciences theorize and the way we now seem to theorize seem to be going in two different ways. And therefore, you know, it's like what Graham Allison said, are we really sitting at separate tables, two separates, to be able to find our way? And finally, maybe just because you said that that there are very few areas of going forward with theory, would you maybe like to comment a little bit as to where you see the role of science and technology in IR and the theorizing of IR? Thank you very much.
If I could just ask you a question, when you say physicists and IR scholars are sitting at separate tables, I wasn't sure what you meant.
Now, I mean, I think it was Graham Allison who wrote this article several years ago saying that we are all becoming so specialized and now we're sitting at separate tables. We kind of do not talk to one another, like economists and, you know, politicians and psychologists and so on and so on, whereas our talks are actually, they have to be interdisciplinary. And in terms of theorizing, like when... I know Professor Aydın Lewell, and I follow his work as well, but one maybe difficulty I had with his ideas was that when I talk about theorizing, what comes to my mind is general applicability. If I'm able to apply it in certain situations and not in certain others, then I question the validity of the theory. And in that sense, am I being too positivist here? Maybe. Or what can we learn from the theorizing and the concepts of theorizing? You mentioned that we are going too much towards hypothesis testing and empiricalism. But the thing is, you know, and maybe not thinking in terms of theory, but where do we find the line? Let's say hard sciences seem to be doing actually a lot of theorizing these days, and testing them through technologies and so on and so on. And maybe we're the ones lagging behind. I just wanted to hear your opinions on that. Thank you.
Okay. There are a lot of points here. First of all, your point about general applicability, I agree completely that theories should apply across the board, regardless of where they're developed. In other words, if a Turkish scholar had developed a powerful theory of realism, a new theory of realism, that should apply widely. It shouldn't apply just to Turkey. So I think you and I are in agreement there. I think, by the way, that's one of the reasons why scholars in the non-Western world gravitate to these Western theories. It's because those Western theories apply broadly. As I said to you, just to personalize it, I find myself more at home in China and in Russia in terms of my theories than I do in the United States. I find Turkey to be a more friendly environment than I find the United States to be on this issue, right? And that just tells you that the theory travels. And this is why I said that I believe that if a homegrown theory, to use Onur and Ersel's rhetoric, if there was a homegrown theory in the non-Western world, it would travel, right? Because theories just travel because they're general statements that have, to use your rhetoric, which I'm sympathetic with, general applicability. With regard to our ability to talk to each other, I think there's no question that the field has become very fragmented and that people don't talk to each other. I think if you look at IR scholarship in Europe and you look at IR scholarship in the United States, there are fundamental differences between those two worlds, and they don't tend to talk with each other at all. And so I think there is that fragmentation. I also think there's a lot of fragmentation inside the United States. You know, realists don't talk much to social constructivists don't talk much to realists. And with regard to methods, I think what's happened is people who do methods don't talk much to people who do theory and vice versa. So there is a lot of fragmentation going on. I just note to you that one thing that strikes me about a lot of scholarship in IR in the, in let's call it the Western world versus the non-Western world, is I think that in the Western world, there's not that much interest in engaging with the policy world. And it's considered to be a bad thing if you engage with the policy world. Whereas I find in the non-Western world, IR scholars are much more interested in how scholarship fits with what's going on in the real world. And this brings me back to a point that Ursel was making. Ursel was saying that IR theory is more popular outside of the West than it is inside the West. I agree with him, okay? The reason I think that IR theory is more popular in the non-Western world is because non-Western scholars are more interested in the real world. You do not want to underestimate the extent to which a Western, certainly an American scholar, will be looked down upon if he or she is deeply involved with policy issues, right? You don't want to go too near the policy world, right? Academics tend to think the policy world and the academic world are two separate worlds. I believe, and this is going to sound funny, but I believe that if you do IR theory, you're much more interested in the real world than you are if you do methods. Methods is less oriented towards real world policy issues than theory is. So I don't find that surprising at all. Your point about it's become impossible to theorize, I don't think it's become impossible to theorize. My point was it's become more difficult to theorize in large part because I think a lot of the theoretical space has been taken up. That's one way I would put it. Again, I want to make it clear, there's still room out there for lots of work, but not as much as there was certainly in 1945 or even in 1975. With regard to your point about the role of science and technology, you could theorize about science and technology in all sorts of ways. I've often thought that a really good subject to theorize about would be the evolution of technology and how it's affected IR. And I've thought that you could focus on information technologies and how information technologies affect IR. You could focus on how destructive technologies like nuclear weapons and so forth and so on affect war. If you're interested in conventional deterrence, right, which is what I started working on way back when, my work on conventional deterrence was all about Europe and the Central Front, because that's what mattered. The whole subject of conventional deterrence and how it relates to East Asia today is very different, right? The war that you worried about in Central Europe is very different than the war you worry about in East Asia in the future between the United States and China. So how does conventional deterrence relate to East Asia? This is a really very interesting question. And that's when technology comes into play. Technology really matters. And by the way, in terms of technology, these Turkish drones that the Ukrainians are using, these Turkish drones that the Azerbaijanis were using against the Armenians, the whole subject of drones, I think you could do some very interesting middle range theoretical work on drones. So I think there are a lot of, you know, interesting subjects related to technology and to science. And by the way, from an American point of view, or at least from my point of view, one of the things that really, really matters is the ongoing technological race between the United States and China. You understand that the Chinese are trying to run us off the board at the technological level. There's an arms race taking place in terms of sophisticated technologies, quantum computing, artificial intelligence, 5G, on and on, right? We're in trouble, right? The United States is in trouble. We are up against a really impressive country. They want to run Silicon Valley off the table, and we are trying to rise to the occasion. So you're going to have this competition in high-end technologies take place over the next, God knows how many decades, right? The United States and China competing, right? And all sorts of interesting things could be said there as well. So I think the role of science and technology, lots of opportunities there. And hopefully people, hopefully you will theorize on this set of subjects.
Thank you very much for your response.
Thank you, Professor. Ashley Jam, you had your hand up.
I just wanted to make a actually quick point because John seems to be repeating a position that I think I have a problem with. The theories, you seem to think that all the ideas and then the theories can travel as freely as possible. From a Western scholar's perspective, or maybe even a prominent established scholar's perspective, that may be the case. But from the peripheral scholar's perspective, the ideas and the theories, they don't travel in the same way. It's very similar to the real world. You either need a visa, money, a sponsor to move beyond your borders. I mean, all of our also kind of the research also shows us that. Or you have to be imitating and selling the same product or adding to that product, then we are given the chance to travel beyond your borders. You seem to think that there is a fair market for the ideas and the theories. From a peripheral perspective, there is no free market. It's a regulated market and excludes the unconventional ideas or unfit, so-called, or not ready to be published, all kinds of things. So it's not a fair market. It doesn't appear to be a fair market. It appears to be an exclusive market with very limited access for many theories. But this is not necessarily because of the market, because of the language and everything else. Also, our graduate training factories, as you cited us, because you are creating copycats in those factories. That's how you flourish. You emerge to become a scholar in the eye of all those ISA journals. If you don't attend the ISA regularly, if you don't make friends there from those journals, then the chance of you getting published is next to almost nothing. Many people would make that argument. So again, in that sense, I seem to think that it's not necessarily a benign hegemony. It's more like a malign hegemony because it's set against new ideas. It's set against new incomers. This market is an exclusive club. What would you think about this position?
Yeah, I just make a couple points. One is, and I wanted to say this earlier to your earlier comments, if you look at elite universities in the United States today, there are lots of non-Western students in those PhD programs. Mm-hmm. It's not like we have a bunch of sort of people who look like me, a bunch of, you know, white Anglo-Saxons or white Americans who dominate and keep out other people. I'm frequently in conversations on Zoom with four or five people where I'm the only American. You know, there's just lots of, I've trained lots of Turkish students, Chinese students, right? Korean, I think I've trained more Korean students than any other group. I go to Korea and, you know, and I just say to you that the West is actually quite welcoming. And we like new ideas. I mean, academia is a place that privileges innovation. It's not a place that, I mean, there is this imperative towards conformity. It's not absent, believe me, I understand that. But there is an imperative towards innovation, to saying something new, right? And you don't want to underestimate that. So we bring in non-Western PhD students. And the truth is, I don't see much difference between them and stereotypical American students. If I bring in somebody from Bangladesh, right, that student basically is not much different than somebody who comes from Los Angeles or, you know, Nebraska. It's just, I don't see that much difference. Now, you would say that's because that student has been socialized earlier to want to conform. I think if you had a student who came from Turkey to the United States, who was really an independent variable, he or she, you know, could think for themselves, and they thought they had a clever theory about how to think about X or Y or Z, that student would be kind of a Bolshevik and would be in your face or in my face telling me they got a new way of thinking about things. And I think the system, assuming that the theory made sense, would reward that person. So I see some socialization for sure, but I don't see as much socialization as you see. And then the other, why don't you go ahead?
No, actually, that's wonderful. For example, when we look at the Turkish example, because you refer to Turkey, admitting for training is one thing, and admitting them in a way that they can bring in. Original, that's where we call homegrown philosophies, ideas into the table is another thing. By the time a student gets his or her education in Turkey, a BA, let's say, right? And then gets socialized into international studies, international relations. And by the time that student gets also selected, based on the GPA, everything else, and the recommendation letter. By the time that student gets into a good graduate school, so-called good graduate school in North America particularly, which we all went through, many of us went through, that person is already assimilated. That person in his or her mind is already assimilated and is already part of this dependent development that person thinks that success means adding to what exists, publish in what it's been published, and become part of the existing club already, and then go back to their country, which I did, for example, and represent the West there, be the ambassador of those ideas and those theories, and get the acknowledgement. I think sometimes our Western colleagues, established colleagues, what they don't follow, how dependent and how assimilating, how homogenizing this whole mechanism is. For example, when I first did my graduate studies, when I wanted, at McGill actually, when I said, hey, can I bring in, for example, I was from the land of Sufi, right? I grew up in Konya. There was an ancient, you know, philosophy, this and that. It was like they were more interested in me providing evidence for their theories, that I meant to be a station chief for ideas that were already produced. I wasn't meant to be a contributor out of the philosophy, even an ancient philosophy, and a perspective from my own land, for example. I should stop, sorry. It's well, your talk. Yeah,
I would just say it's too bad you didn't come to the University of Chicago instead of go to McGill. And if you okay. had worked with me, I would have given you plenty of room to roam. I want to just push this a bit further because it's a very important issue. Mm-hmm. You're basically saying that these young people who are educated in Turkey are educated almost completely on the basis of a Western canon, a Western literature, a Western body of IR theories. And that you're effectively saying there are no homegrown theories that they are exposed to. Is that fair to say?
Pretty much so, John, yeah.
Why is that? I just want to be very clear here. I've dealt with lots of non-American, non-Western students, and they are every bit, ceteris paribus, they are every bit as good as Western students. It's not like Western students are smarter than non-Western students. That's not what's going on here, right? I had some Turkish students who are really whipsaw smart, okay? But you're telling me that when they come to the University of Chicago, they're no different than somebody coming from LA or Nebraska, right? I should expect nothing different from Turkish students. That's kind of hard. It's kind of a hopeless situation, isn't it? It
simply reflects the long years of dependent development that their professors in their home countries already were trained in the West or in Western, you know, theories or Western theoretical thinking, that they already got socialized into a role that they want to continue because they think that's the way to success because this is a competitive world, I think. But otherwise, how can we explain that, look, Turkey is coming from an imperial past as well. There were different civilizations in here. There were different perspectives, philosophies, all kinds of things. Yet there hasn't been, and some type of a theory or a theoretical application that reflects that past, that reflects that philosophy. It is more like most of us, all of us, in fact, we are pretty much busy and occupied with what we learned, not what we brought in to the table.
Okay, just my final point on this, because we should go back to questions. If there is a Turkish theory out there to be articulated, and it hasn't been articulated, obviously, somebody should articulate that Turkish theory, right? And your argument is it will be suppressed. I do not believe it will be suppressed, but first you got to articulate the theory. I go through this when I go to China. The Chinese are actually kind of resentful that they employ Western theories, and they talk about the need to invent Chinese theories of international politics. And I always say it would be wonderful if you would invent Chinese theories of international politics, but they haven't done that yet. And the Turks have not invented, you have not invented a Turkish theory of international politics. And I would challenge you, you an owner, instead of writing another piece on the state of the field, right? What you should do is write a major theoretical work that differs from what people like me are saying in the West, that challenges us and offers us a new theory of international politics. I think that would be wonderful. And if you have trouble selling it around the globe, please contact me and I'll go to great lengths to help you purvey that theory all over the planet. Because you and I agree on the importance of theory, and owner too. We all agree, right? Theory is God. So give us a new theory.
That's the deal, John. No, in fact, we even wrote another article basically making the claim that this is more like a peripheral responsibility. It is more like a peripheral responsibility rather than the core, because the core doesn't have to make a move. It's the, you know, it doesn't. It's happy where it is, what it does, and it serves to also its, you know, everything else. But you're right. It's a peripheral responsibility, unfortunately. Yeah.
We're starting to run out of time, but there are a couple of questions that I think are sort of worth bringing up because I think they're very interesting. One of them is, well, we see that a lot of the mainstream IR theories seem to fail in explaining some of the, let's say, developments in the rest of the world. For example, let's look, if we think about deterrence, for example, we see that some of the ideas that are developed in deterrence theory don't seem to hold very well when looking at the relation, looking at India's relationship with Pakistan, for example, or when we look at India's relationship with the US and China. Sometimes they seem to be very supportive of the US, other times they're different. So whichever way you seem to look at it, there seems to be a great deal of, let's say, inconsistencies. And so should we not maybe bestow greater importance to locally developed theories, since the people there themselves, you know, they experience a particular social reality, they have their own perspective, their own sort of history as well. Should that not be, should there not be, a stronger emphasis on trying to flesh out these ideas and bringing them into a mainstream, IR mainstream? Second question, if I may, since we're a little bit low on time, I also want to ask this. Assuming that language is important for the development of ideas and worldviews and thoughts, does the rest of the world, or the non-Anglophone world, aren't the people of the non-Anglophone world automatically at a disadvantage? Because even if they were to somehow come up with exceptional ideas, or maybe if they were forced to think about a discipline in another language, would this not, let's say, stifle some of their thoughts? So isn't the US and the UK, for example, at an automatic, I don't want to say they're at an advantage, but the rest of the world is at a disadvantage. So those are two questions that I think really worth, that deserve, I think deserve some attention. Sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah, those are both excellent questions. Let me take them in reverse order.
Okay.
I think that you need a lingua franca, you know, you need a common language. It happens to be English, right? And from my point of view, that's a wonderful thing because I speak great English. And your point is, if somebody doesn't speak great English, doesn't that put them at something of a disadvantage? The answer is yes. I mean, how could it be otherwise, right? I can read, somebody who's not terribly adept at the English language cannot read an article or a book as quickly as I can. So if you're gonna get into this business and operate at the high end, you obviously have to speak English. And I think, again, there's no way the global discipline could work without a common language, right? And you could argue it should be Chinese, but then those Chinese speakers would have an advantage over the non-Chinese speakers. It just happens that it's English, which from my point of view is a wonderful thing. But as you point out, it's going to put other people at something of a disadvantage. I don't think a big disadvantage. And many people around the world who are not sort of native English speakers speak English better than many Americans do. But your general point holds. I just don't see a way around it. Your first question, fascinating question, which gets to the essence of what theory is, and we have not talked much about this at all. The reason that theory is God and theory is so terribly important is that the world is enormously complicated, and we need simple tools for making sense of that enormously complicated world. And those simple tools are theories. And anytime you come up with a theory, it's a simplification of reality. If you're a structural realist like me, what you focus on almost exclusively is the structure of the international system, which means you pay hardly any attention to domestic politics or to individual leaders, right? Whether a country is a democracy or an autocracy or a communist state, doesn't matter in my structural realist story, which is, again, a simplification of reality. Well, sometimes those factors that you leave on the cutting room floor, when you develop your simple theory, they really matter. And that means your theory is going to be wrong in that particular case. You know, I wrote this book with Steve Walt on the Israel lobby. It's called The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. I'm sure many of you have heard of it. Lots of people would say to us, because Steve is a realist like I am, do you guys realize that the Israel Lobby book contradicts your realist theory? And we'd say, yes. And you could see the smoke coming out of their ears. How could that possibly be that they admitted that the Israel lobby contradicts their basic realist theory? Our argument is sometimes domestic politics matters. And in those cases where domestic politics matters, our theory is going to be proved wrong. My view, Onur, is that if your theory is proved right 75% of the time, you're in the Hall of Fame, okay? 75% of the time. That's my intuition. I can't prove that that's the right number. My intuition is you're right 75% of the time you're in the Hall of Fame. Peter Katzenstein, once hearing me say that, said, if you're right 50% of the time, you're in the Hall of Fame. All of this is to say that theories are sometimes wrong. There are real limits to what theory can do, but nevertheless, theories are indispensable. Now, your argument was that because these general theories are wrong, maybe if we developed local theories, they would do a better job. I'll go back to the woman who asked me, I think, one of the first questions about theories, her point that theories have general applicability. I think even homegrown theories, I think when you and Ursel invent your theory, right, it will have general applicability, right? All of that is to say your theory, let's assume that you produce a great theory, your theory will be wrong 25% of the time and right 75% of the time, right? So it's going to be wrong. So I don't see any meaningful difference between what you folks call homegrown theories or the existing general theories that are out there. They're all just limited tools. Very important to understand that. Theories have real limits. They're real limits to what they can tell you, but they are absolutely indispensable. Theory is God. If you want to understand the real world, And this goes back to Ursel's earlier point, why theory is so popular in the periphery or the non-Western world, because scholars in the periphery or the non-Western world are much more interested in the real world, and they need theories to understand the world. That's why theory is God. But again, limits to theory. And I don't distinguish between homegrown theories and Western theories. I think for me, theories are theories. Who invents them is largely irrelevant. I think that matters more for you guys than it does for me. But that's sort of my bottom line on that.
Okay, thank you, Professor Mearsheimer. Well, I think we're just about done. If you'd like to, add anything else, any final thoughts, any final parting ideas anybody would like to bring up, please do so. Hocam, maybe you had something to add. Oh, you're muted. Please.
Okay, first of all, it's my honor to be here from Gaziantep University, Western Languages and Literatures Department. And I have some doubts about which factors are influential in the diminishing role of theory. For example, I question whether global megatrends are also influential in that. For example, population growth or the role of education in the changing the world of age of technology and in the age of market economy or in the age of, postmodern society. For example, do we need, as a local example in Turkey, we need in fact more technicians than intellectuals for our economy, for the good of our economy, but we have more intellectuals than technicians in Turkey. So the quantity of people who have higher education, especially graduate education, is the status inversely proportional with the diminishing role of theory. I question whether it is. For example, we don't need that number of intellectuals in Turkey. Instead, we need a great number of technicians. How about the situation globally? For example, another factor, another global mega factor.
Professor, I'm so sorry. Could you keep it brief, please? I'm so sorry.
Okay. I question whether the diminishing role of education is proportional with global mega trends. Such as population growth and the need for technicians instead of intellectuals globally. Rather than tension between center and periphery.
Well, just a couple quick points. I think, if anything, there's an increasing role for education around the world. Huge numbers of people in the non-Western world are getting educated in ways that was not the case in the past, and there's no evidence that the emphasis on education is slowing down inside the Western world as well. It's amazing how many people on this planet are well educated in IR theory. I can tell you that from my emails. It's really quite amazing. With regard to the point about we have too many intellectuals, and not enough technicians. First of all, I think that those are not mutually exclusive categories, and that you want a lot of intellectuals and you want a lot of technicians. So I wouldn't privilege one over the other. I would just say a word or two about the word intellectual. This is a very interesting word. When I went to graduate school, I was a TA for a professor. He was a very prominent comparativist. And I was in his office one day, and he said to me, John, he said, why did you come to graduate school? What did you want to become? And I had never thought of that question in my life. I had no answer, right? I mean, why did I come to graduate school? So my brain started spinning around, and I said to him, I came to graduate school because I wanted to become an intellectual. He said to me, wrong. He said, you came to graduate school because you want to become a social scientist. So you see, he distinguished between being a social scientist and being an intellectual. I thought about that conversation immediately thereafter and for many years. And I used to tell people that I was a social scientist, not an intellectual, okay? In recent years, this is maybe the past 10 or 15 years, I've come to the conclusion that you want to be both a social scientist and an intellectual. And what I mean by that is you want to have a lot of intellectual curiosity. For the younger people out there who are just starting your careers, you want to be intellectually curious. You want to know everything about everything. You want to read the New York Review of Books. You want to read conservative equivalents and so forth and so on. You want to read stuff from other countries. You want to know about all sorts of issues that are not germane to what you're writing about or reading about for your academic work. So you want to be intellectually curious. And you also want to be a first-rate social scientist, because being able to theorize and being able to do empirical work, I fear that I place too much emphasis on theory and not enough emphasis on doing good empirical work. You want to do good empirical work. We have to test our theories, right? So it's very important to get skilled in methods and to be skilled in developing theory, right? You want to be a first-rate social scientist with a lot of intellectual curiosity. So all of that is to say, I believe you want to be a social scientist and an intellectual, and you don't want to diss the technicians who are out there, because we need technicians as well as social scientists and intellectuals.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Well, in that case, I'm going to conclude here. We're a little bit over time. Thank you, everyone, so much for joining us. Hopefully, we'll be able to organize more of these talks in the future. And hopefully, we'll have many more opportunities to talk about the global IR debate and other developments in the IR discipline. So thank you very much. And Professor Mersheimer, thank you. This was very enlightening for us as well. It'll give us something to respond to in the future as well. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Owner and Ursel.
Thank you so much. It was so stimulating. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for always inspiring us. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Be well, everyone.
You too.
You too.
You too.
You too.